wanna walk into a cold, bitter ocean, feel the sting of letting go of all hope and soak in the ache of this heartbreak. I wanna drive fast till I break down in nowhere, so I can finally cry these tears. When I reach there, I'll scream, yeah, I'll let it all out. But right now it's just me, alone on this earth. So I'm gonna sing. Without any questions, run into danger and show no emotions. Forget your name, wipe your lips off my pain. But right now it's just me, alone on this earth. So I'm gonna sing.
Friday morning. So good morning to you. And I had a little Peyton Davis kind of Jones going, so I wanted to hear her voice. Haven't heard her voice this week. And we're going to do the nightly roundtable here with myself, the gunner, Mike Musselman, and Dr. Goldberg. So they just got back from dinner. Thoughts on the day? What'd you think, Josh?
Yeah, I thought it was another... outstanding, and to use the gunner's word, at times overwhelming day, and overwhelming in a positive sense, and just the opportunity to get to talk to more people. We had a relatively intimate gathering with the spouses tonight, and I think which was, you know, it's interesting when you mix up the styles and you do it in such a small setting and the voices come down and there's no microphones and you really get to see the emotion and the impact in each person's eyes, because it's not quite so many people. And I think it's just interesting in these different venues to get to see the impact it makes, and more words shared and more ideas.
It just continues. I mean, it continues to be just that powerful impact. And, I mean, you can feel it deep inside you. I mean, that's what it, today, these two characters welled up. And again, my acting abilities, I can talk while I'm still almost crying. So I'm pretty good. I was at that
he
point.
He sent me, speaking of that, just to complete Mike's thought, General Furness does his introduction this morning, and his voice breaks during the introduction, and I'm like, oh.
He keeps trying to push
and
through.
And I put we're doing this at night, so, and it'll play Friday, but it was this morning. January 10th is my sister, who just younger than me by about 13 months, Maureen's birthday. And she died of exposure due to alcohol poisoning about 4 years ago. And so I've never included her picture in any of this. And I don't know why. I don't know if it was that sensitive to me that I just didn't want to go there. And I thought today is her birthday, and I... And, you know, today's a lot of days. Josh's dad's birthday and the anniversary of his friend. But her picture came up, and I tried to talk through it, and I had to stop a couple times. And then Josh, when he tried to talk about it,
right.
And I thought,
let me explain something for everybody. Today,
the doors were falling off this morning.
What Mac did when he put Maureen's picture up there, and I've never met her. I've always heard Mac talk about his younger sister. And, you know, the compassion. It's like any sibling talking about someone they love. And, you know, again, as long as I've known him, he's always talked about his family in that sense, his siblings. And, what he did today was he honored his younger sister, her life and what it meant to Mac. And you could see it on his face as he was talking. And I know Mac is the kind of guy, he doesn't like get in touch with those feelings. Because his heart is small and he wants to keep it small because
exactly.
It doesn't have to pump so hard and he can live longer. But today his heart grew 10 times.
Well, I'll tell you about my sister. When we were kids, my dad's in professional baseball, and so we get out of school, you know, the first or second week of June, like we used to as kids. And my mom would throw us in the car, and if my dad was managing Birmingham, Alabama, Dallas, Texas. Mobile, Alabama, Binghamton, New York. We drive across the country with my mom as kids, right? No air conditioning, right? Don't touch me. Get your leg off me, right? Playing car bingo, no seatbelts on. My mom smoking her parliaments, and my sister was an athlete. And so, we played sports all the time. And she was a really good athlete. And, I mean, it's sad because as her demons kind of came out in her early 20s, we drifted apart, and then she got involved in alcohol, and I don't allow people in the inner sanctum once they violate it too many times, you know, Peggy was really difficult, you know, after high school. I mean, she was really hard on our family and my mom, and I watched it and watched it and watched it, and it affected my behavior, and I thought, I'm never going to do that to my parents. And I didn't have a beer till I was 19. Till I was 19 years old. And then I went away to college and, you know, I did normal college stuff. And so, that part, I mean, it was hard because she was one of my, growing up, she was my best friend. She was a good athlete because we played baseball. We played football. We played basketball. And there was two other kids on our block that played all the time and me. And so Maureen was fourth and she was good. She went to high school, an all-girls Catholic high school. I went to all-boys Catholic high school. And they had a homecoming game, a powder puff football game every year. So Maureen's a freshman. And she's quarterbacking one of the teams. And they had practice. And, you know, girls football, right? Maureen did play football like a girl, man. She quarterback, she gets the ball, she goes back to pass. She throws like a 30-yard strike, hits this girl in stride, and everybody's like, what was that? And my dad was managing a Major League Baseball at the time, so the TV cameras would come out to film John McNamara's daughter, and her first play of her life, that was like her annual coronation, Maureen McNamara. And so just a terrible story. I mean, she had every gift God could give somebody. But she had big demons, and so, today was her birthday. But, you know, this morning was a shit show. Us all getting emotional, right? And then we had audio visual problems, but we got through those, and yeah.
Yeah, and it is the ability to honor Maureen. A year ago today, I got a call from one of my best friends that his son, who's 17, had taken his life, and certainly woke up with that heavy on my heart and heavy on my mind, and thinking about him, and started to go there. And that wasn't just a voice cracking; it was like, you know, real welling up in just a moment. And you stop, and Matt talks about being gentle with yourself, and it's a moment to stop and reflect and honor him, who I knew, and honor Jake and honor his family. And and then the other part, because it's not just that we're getting the chance to share this message, which is important, and it's not just that we get to see people change, like General Furness and other people, and it's not just in what people tell us, it's what we actually learn from one another as well. And this sort of notion of that Max hit hard is, you know, don't say stupid shit if you don't know what to say. And certainly at funerals, and I reflected and thought about my friend and all of the stupid things that people told him about, you know, and somehow it's comforting that someone they know in some removed way had taken their own life and all of these sorts of things, and just and how dumb and how hurtful that can be. And so those are sort of the thoughts I had in my mind, and just honoring him. And so for me, it's like, what better way of honoring that loss in talking to a bunch of young men who he could have been, because he did have some aspirations to go in the military, talking to them and hopefully sending a message to them that allows them to make sure that no matter what they go through in their life, they can stay. And that's all I can do on this day. It felt like that's what I needed to be doing and where I needed to be. And I'm just grateful for the opportunity to do that and to bring Jake into that room with me.
And it's a sharing thing. So, you know, we've been doing this all week and telling the story and listening to these kids come up and, you know, shake your hand and say, thank you. You spoke to me. I'm suffering from the same thing. I'm glad someone else has spoken about this. Now I don't feel so alone anymore. Last night after we left here, I got back down to my room, and then the whole week kind of just caught up to me and what people have been saying. And it was really kind of an anxiety moment hit me. And I was just, you know, like, oh God, you know, let's just get through this. And then, today, I think it was the first session, maybe been the second, everything's a blur. One of the Marines came up, I think he was a staff sergeant, and, he was real quiet. You know, they're always real quiet. And he came up and he just stuck his hand out and he said, sir, I really appreciate you telling that story because I've been there. I mean, wasn't too long ago. I actually did the same thing you did. And, you know, and I connected with that because, you know, listen to your story. I was there, and now hearing you and where you're at, he goes, I need to get there. This is the start. And there's a promise I can look at you and say, if he did it, you know, I can do it. And, he was really, I mean, you could see, like you said, you know, he was, I would say happy is the wrong word, more relieved to know that he's not alone. And that was kind of the big point. You know, I was like, I had to step outside for a little bit and get some cold air on me because it was really kind of a moving experience. And that's the beauty of this. You know, as you relieve them of their burden, you know, you take a little bit of it, you know, on you.
And give them hope.
I mean, give them hope.
That's so cool. And then, so explain this to me. At 11:57, we're finishing up the morning and you're up on the stage and I'm sitting behind you with General Furness. And you text, this shit is incredibly moving. And then he turns around, he likes pointing at the phone, and I look and I read it, and I'm like, uh-oh, what's going on? What was going on when you did that?
Because I looked out, when we were talking, I looked out and made eye contact with one of the Marines, and he had an allergy moment.
Oh, really?
And, you know, he was welling up. I mean, he was trying really hard to fight it back because he was with his buddies and he didn't want to look like, you know, he was human. And, you know, it's just, we caught eyes for a second there and he just kind of gave me a grin, you know, and I kind of smiled at him. And, you know, just kind of that, we just, you know, it sounds corny, but you know, you share that moment with somebody that it's in pain and they, you can feel the relief going out of them. You know, he's just like,
you know, and that's such a great word, Mike. And I remember, and I tell a story about talking to a Marine in 2006 in Fallujah. And, he's the one, you've heard me tell the story about the EOD team that went into the Zaydon. And then on their way out, they hit an IED. The vehicle's fully engulfed. Their gunny doesn't get out. And they try to get him three different times. The ordnance in the back of the truck is cooking off. The truck's fully engaged. They have another Marine who's got his thigh opened up with arterial bleeding, so he's an urgent medevac. But we don't have fire trucks, and they have to sit there all night and guard it and be ready to be ambushed and smell, you know, not only the vehicle but their gunny, the guy who led them, and they feel like they failed. And a couple weeks gone by, and I talked to him, and I'd heard that he was struggling, so I brought him to the COC. I said, tell him I need to see him. So he comes in. I said, sit down. I want to talk to you. And when we sat down, and it's a story where I looked at him and said, you think you're fucked up, don't you? And he looked at me like, I don't know. And I said, that's when I said, you are fucked up. And he started laughing, and I started laughing. I said, but just like everybody else in here, there's nothing wrong with you. You're going to be okay. And the word relief, honestly, it's almost like his body went physically like sagged, like, thank you. I've been worried that there's something irreparably wrong with me. And all of a sudden I find out that I'm like everybody else, and it's okay to be like this. And I think relief is such an appropriate word. And it's such a cool experience to keep doing this.
And it reminds me of the Elizabeth Smart stuff. You know, I'm not shattered. I'm not broken. I'm Elizabeth Smart. And that's that core idea. It's like we somehow believe this stuff happens and we break and we're defective and we don't want to acknowledge it, because if you do, then you're giving fuel to something you can't fix, and it's the end, and it's not true. And what I kept being struck by today, because you listen to the people that come up and they'll say, you know, thank you so much, right? You know, and this is my experience. And the inane part to me that's so frustrating is that there is no roadmap for people and there's no guidance. And so what ends up happening is
there is now.
Well, let me finish. But this is the inane part about the world before PTW, post-traumatic weaning, is that
PTW.
But the inane part is that, so somebody who's struggling, right? Things aren't going okay. They're struggling. They're trying to deal with all this stuff. And then not only are they dealing with that, but then you put the additional burden that they have to go be Sherlock Holmes and try to figure out, you know, what is the book? What is the thing to listen to? What's the thing to watch? And they have to go and try to navigate this in the hopes that they find a silver bullet or a thing that really speaks to them. And that's what, you know, when people come up and, you know, one guy says, you mentioned Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. He goes, I thought it was crazy because I read that book and it made such an impact on me. And I'm like, Mike, like, how do we not have an encyclopedia of, like, struggle, right, of trauma? It's the one constant in the life of every human being, and yet it's like the hidden treasures that are buried somewhere that occasionally get unearthed in some books that may or may not have insight or speak to people. And that's why this stuff's important, because it's like, enough, right? Enough of this shit, enough of making people who are already in a bad place have to do really hard things that they may not succeed at, and the cost can be their lives. So let's get this stuff out, put it in a way that people can understand, create a roadmap that provides them an opportunity to be able to do what it is they want to do, which is to live and live well, because no one wants to feel that way. It's just hard to figure out any other way to do it, and then drugs and alcohol kick in and the rest of it. So that's the part to me where I'm like, you know, God bless these folks for being able to figure it out, but why did we make them do that? Why did the people, you know? And
no, you know, I look at these gaps, these educational gaps. And, you know, in 1990, I looked at, you know, a tactical one for us. We wanted you to be decisive. We didn't teach you anything about what it is to be a decision maker. We just looked at it and said, make a decision, Lieutenant. Make a decision, Sergeant. And then we yelled at you if it wasn't right. We didn't do any of the intermediate work. So, I don't know, but that's what feels so good about this, and it's so cool that everybody's so appreciative. A couple things today. First of all, the first person I ever heard that talked about not saying those things at funerals was Rabbi Kushner in When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Things he had said to people for decades, for at least a couple decades, when he wrote the book. You know, that, you know, there's a purpose in this. And then when people said it to him, he felt like I felt. How dare you say that to me? And then he felt ashamed that he had said it to other people. That was the first time I ever felt it. And then living it, you know, absolutely, absolutely brutal. The other thing I want to say is today, I said this yesterday, but one of the things I love about my friends is they're intellectuals. They don't act like it. All right, but they are intellectuals. And today, you know, General Furness, his opening has changed throughout the week. It has got deeper. It has got richer. And today I was working on putting stuff on the resource page of the website during lunch. And all of a sudden he texts me two pictures of his family with no message. I'm like, and I text back, those are good-looking people. And so then he walks into the cafe, the kind of little coffee cafe they have. And he plops down. And he goes, "Hey, what's up?" I said, "Nothing." And he said, "I sent you two pictures." I said, "Yeah, it's a good-looking family. Will you put those in a slide and put it up?" And so we talked about him talking about his daughter, Elizabeth, and how he found out that she was had a learning disability and would live with them forever and whatnot. And he shared that with everybody. The following day, that wasn't good enough. He wanted to make the experience even more acute for everybody by bringing pictures of his family. And it's just, it makes your heart happy, and it makes you proud that these are my friends. And you don't have to push them, nudge them to do the right thing for other Marines as leaders. They get it on every, and it's just been such a cool week to hang out with them. And even tonight, after we got done from 2:30 to 5 o'clock doing the afternoon show, we got in a vehicle, we went out to the officer club, and we did it again for spouses. And he stayed for the whole thing. His wife showed up for the second time. The spouses not only stayed, but they stayed afterwards to kind of talk and have a little bit of roundtable discussion, which we hadn't done before. And they were truly interested in it. And he stayed the whole time. And so it's just, you know, like we tell you, we've been sharing with Josh. These are our friends. He met Joe Guerrero last night. And Superman, Brock. Can you imagine being in harm's way with those kind of men and what you feel like and how good it feels to be in that kind of company? It's as Mike and I said, it's like combat heaven with all these guys that get it on all these different levels. So it's been a very cool week.
And at some point, Furness, he made a comment, something about, you know, and I've heard it many times, you know, it's if you want to see what someone's priorities are, look at where they put their time. And that guy, who's, I'm sure, pretty darn busy, he has spent 25 hours in 4 days listening to us over 10 sessions. And, yeah, he's become an expert and immersed himself in it. But the fact is he sits there through the entire thing. And I think in part because he's curious and in part because he wants to send that message. And it staggers me. And I can't recall if I mentioned it last night, but we spend a lot of time talking about what it means to be a complete human being and a complete leader. And when you see one and see multiple, and these are people that Mac and Mike had shared with me stuff about, and then you meet them, and of course, at this point, 25 hours is a long time in 4 days to spend with somebody. And you're like, holy cow, these people are the real deal. And I'm an indoor Jew, so I can't say, you know, go to war, but I'm like, if he was like, hey, we need you, let's go, I'd be like, all right, where are we going? You know, well, actually, I probably wouldn't even ask, but like, all right, let's go. You know, what do I need to take? And you just have this sense that these people inspire loyalty because they're earnest and true. And I think part of that reason is what I said last night, which is this notion of being congruent. And it's when
– hold on. I just want to say something. They don't inspire loyalty. All right. What they do is they perform their way into loyalty. They don't ask for your loyalty. They win it. By what they do every day, and that's how cool. There's some people that occupy a billet, and you're supposed to be loyal. There's others that assume that billet, and they win your loyalty, and they prove it to you every day.
Well, these guys do it by showing loyalty to the Marines, and so it's the same thing. You know, it's the beauty of, you know, you have your good unit when nothing has to be said, and it's just what the actions, what the expectation is of what he needs, because he's done it for you. He's shown you expectation by showing you what matters, because he devotes his time. And yeah, inspire is the wrong word for these guys, because they show leadership. They show this by demonstrating it, in the most pure form. And the Marines pick it up real quick. I mean, they don't have to be told. This is silent leadership at its best.
And maybe it's earned, right? They earn it on a consistent basis. I don't know what the right grammar is, but I think the key here is that when there is a delta between your words and your deeds, and so between your audio and your video, when those don't match, we know that people look at what you do, not what you say. And when you see, and this is a problem in a lot of this stuff with mental health, it's people telling you stuff that they haven't lived. And we know, and I know from this community, that the only people you truly trust are the ones who've been there and done it. Lived experience, man in the arena, Teddy Roosevelt shit. And so when you see people who talk about why this stuff's important.
But I don't know, not only been there and done it, been there and excelled at it. Because, you know, I think Mike and I, we've all kind of lived the same existence. And saying things like, look, my job is to every day prove to you that if we all take our rank off, you look at me and say, we want him to be the CEO. And that's what he lives. He lives that. Right? And my, what Mike lived was every day, if we had to make somebody the gunner, I'm going to be that guy. Right? I'm going to be the wild card guy in this, and you're going to vote me that because of who I am. And that's, and when you go out every day and you earn it, you prove it to them. It's, and like I said, like we've said ad nauseum, we had Joe, Brock, Mike, me, Napa Man, Chris Bronzy. It's like, it was intoxicating.
Yeah. And I,
with him in the lead, and he would say, look, my job is just to get out of the way, create the environment, because I don't even have to tell you guys to go. You guys just stand there like this. And then Mike's already gone. He's like, where's Gunner at this? He's not at the starting line. Oh, he left 15 minutes ago. He's cheating again.
Well, and I think that it may be, you know, there's the warfighter part. I just mean you sitting there and people, how many people are like, oh, you know, it's okay to talk about it. It's okay to not be okay. You know, everyone goes through this stuff. And it's just, it feels like platitudes, right? Because there's nothing genuine or earnest or authentic about it. And then homeboy gets up there, adds the pictures, talks about this stuff in a way that reflects his ongoing learning and understanding of it. And that's the piece where I'm like, there's no faking the funk. There's no one who thinks this perfunctory Mando BS. No skits or any of this nonsense. It's like, wow. Right. Not only does he care, but he's living what he's doing. And to be fair, and to our credit, each of us do the same thing. And that's what makes this effective, is that there's no disconnect.
Yeah, the big change, when I was talking to Linda tonight, Dave's wife, you know, I had asked him, it was just before he had told her, this is what I've been doing. He hadn't told his wife, he'd been sharing this with the Marines. So he kind of just immediately walked over there and said, hey, by the way, what I've been doing is sharing our story with Elizabeth. And she nodded, and then, you know, he went on and talked, and then right after that, I had looked at her and said, you know, have you noticed much of a change? She said, the first night we did this where we were here together tonight, that night, there's a change. And so, yeah, I think she's excited too, because now she's, as we said, you know, jokingly to Dave, was, you know, we pointed out, hey, he's showing that he's really a soft guy and he's caring. And, you know, we were bagging on him a little bit, because people don't see this kind of stuff in these kind of people. And this is new ground for him.
Well, so, you know what? It's new ground for us. I mean, Mike said, look, I wish I had learned this stuff years ago, because I love the way I am now, right? That I'm not afraid to go to these different places to help these people. I would have been this guy sooner. And it is one of the things that kind of grates on me. As happy as I am to do this, it's not like it's that complex. I mean, we were having a conversation today about we're talking about the linear nature of graphing. Here's your life and drawing a line horizontally. Well, that's wrong, because your life is never a flat line. Your life is a wave. And so to me, what's wonderful about that is that wave is the adversity and the trauma of life. That's normal. The flat line isn't normal unless you're dead. And so, so we were talking about how to graphically depict that. And then, because Josh was talking about, well, and then this goes down here, and then, and I don't know if we're talking about what we're using resilience, and then you're supposed to go back there. And I was saying, no, but if it's a wavy line, then you're down there naturally. You're not down there because of, you know, and that's the natural thing. And if you can get everybody to understand that that's life naturally, as opposed to, oh, adversity hits and I go down there. No, life is that naturally. Then you're normal.
Yeah, but and that's – so two things. One, so the guy I work with, my partner Ken, writes all the time, life's a series of ups and downs. It's just what it is. It's a natural effect. And That's the myth of resilience. The myth of resilience is the flat line, is not just the world is desirable. When you depart from said line, the goal is to bounce back to the line. And that's not, it's not possible. So that's the myth of resilience. That's why it's not a good term. Now, you know, you could talk about trauma resistance and debate that and the capacity for people to be able to go through this stuff. But as we said, no matter who you are, when some of this stuff hits, it's going to rock your world. And then the recognition of like, okay, this happened. This is my response to it. There's nothing wrong with me, right? I'm not going to get over it. And it's like, okay, now what? And now I start to go from just trying to cope with it and survive it to living with it and then understanding it and then sharing it and so forth. And that seems to be the process. So it's like that's why resilience bugs us so much as a word, because it's a false paradigm. It's not true. It doesn't exist. It's not possible. And yet, what do? We go around telling our soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, you need to be more resilient. It's like, no, they don't. They're strong. And when stuff hits you hard enough, I don't care. No one has that, and that's the point, because that world doesn't account for the fact that life is traumatic and struggle and so forth. And that's what made me chuckle a little bit when this young man came up today and said, hey, I was in your talk yesterday. Thank you so much. It's really going to, I didn't need it, but it's going to help me help people. And I'm like, and that's the joy, because, I almost killed myself because when I did need it, I didn't know where to get it. And so it's like, oh, imagine that someone has it before they need it, right, instead of needs it and can't find it. That's a world I love to live in, because, hey, he's got that stuff. He's got the 8 commandments on his phone. He'll be good to go, because if all he's doing is helping people with it, he'll internalize it. Because if you want to learn something, teach it to somebody else, and he'll be relatively good to go. And that's what's exciting.
Yeah, for him, it's going to be more of a preventive medicine where he can – he knows once he starts this, he knows where to find it. And then you can easily pull yourself out. It would be like that we were just having a discussion about if you could start off early, how early would you start off? Think again, pulling all this aside, this would have made me a better parent. I would have understood more of dealing with where I came from, how I was made and how I am, and then how I can divert from that and understand that and accept that and deal with that, and then not pass those traits on to our children so they have to deal with it, and so on and so forth. You can break the chain if you catch this early enough. You can break this, I don't know if it's a paradigm shift where we would, you can actually snap it before it becomes an issue, where through proper training and evaluation and, you're looking at things before they become a problem. It's that same, inoculating or vaccinating.
Yeah, and it's like we were talking about today, right? Mindset's everything. If you accept the world in which trauma is inevitable, it's valuable, it will affect you, it won't go away, and you can do good things with it. And if that's your mindset, then you have a mindset that can assimilate and integrate. Sometimes it takes time, the stuff that happens in life. And that's the core of the Stockdale paradox. That's why I love Jim Stockdale, because it's like, all right, boys, we're going to have a real-world understanding of just how messed up this situation is. We're not going to pretend like we're getting out of Christmas. We're not going to carry around false hope. We're going to accept this is for what it is. And we're going to maintain the faith to know that no matter what happens, we will not simply survive or endure, but we will thrive because of the experience. And if that's your mindset, then you should be good to go as long as you're gentle to yourself, as long as you do the stuff that we talk about, then you're good to go. And that's where with the kids, if that's your mindset, what does that mean you teach your kids? Doesn't mean you try to solve their problems, lawnmower, helicopter. It means you recognize and you teach them that that's true about life. And those are the teaching moments when those things happen, is you get the chance to talk about that. And then your kids get it. And then they have the ability to deal with this instead of, our goal of protecting people and making them comfortable, which I know is probably a little bit distinct, and we talked about it last night. But I think that's a natural inclination of parents, is to protect their kids from struggle and harm. And in the not harm, but struggle. But in the process, they teach that wrong lesson that bad things equals difficult lives.
Yeah. I still love, to me, this whole week, for me, the eye-opener was the rabbi, the lobster analogy. Because, it's that, I was thinking about this today. I was thinking, when I saw it again and again on the TV or on the screen, and I was watching him, I just love his body language and the way he talks and the way he articulates it. But in my mind, I'm thinking to myself,
hold on, people have to see this, because when you see this, he looks like he's out of central casting, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is like...
Josh, I mean, you're a Jew. I mean, it is like...
This is amazing.
When central casting draws the picture of a Jewish rabbi, this is a guy.
This was... But, you know, so I'm watching the video, and my thought in my mind was, if I would have only understood this and practiced this when I first came in the Marine Corps, I would have been the biggest, baddest, meanest looking lobster on the bottom of the ocean floor. I mean, I would have been growing like there's no tomorrow. And, you know, and I would have been king of the floor right down there. That would have been something else. I would have been struggling and growing.
You know, every time Matt gets up, he's like, I'm going to talk to you about the two goals and the eight commandments. And I just laugh to myself internally. And I haven't yet said it. And I'm trying to be mindful of how much time I take up there. But I'm like, oh, you know, I know why I'm here, right? When anyone's trying to issue new commandments, you need a Jew around, right, to receive said commandments from the mountaintop. And I just, it kept coming back to me that this idea. But this rabbi, not only is he central casting, then he's fixing, which is called a yarmulke or kippah, which is right. The head covering he wears during this thing. And he's a little bit sloppy. And in the video, my favorite part is he's like, I picked up this article, and it was, you know, why do lobsters grow? And he goes, I don't care why lobsters grow. And then he says, but I was interested. And I'm like, Right. Wait, what? Like, so it's not just, it's also off the cuff. And then all of a sudden he just drops the knowledge. It's like, boom, you know, how you like me now? And it's like, okay, got you, Rabbi.
You know, we've done this thing 9 times. We've seen all these videos. One on Monday.
Seven, eight, nine. Ten.
Oh, we added the one on Wednesday night. We've done this thing 10 times, and I love watching the videos in this. And for those of you listening, you can watch all the videos there. If you go to the All Marine Radio website, if you go to the Post Traumatic Winning tab, and you click on that, and you'll see resources. Click on that, and you'll see a whole series of videos there. Those are the videos that we use here. And the Elizabeth Smart, you know, video is, I could watch that on a loop forever. She is to me.
Thank you, Gunner.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gunner. Don't knock me for watching Lifestyle.
Lifetime.
Lifetime channel.
Lifetime channel.
The Varnado Simpson one, I just look at that as, and we were talking before we came on about the tragedy of that. And, you know, I've told this, his mother was an x-ray technician, a black nurse in 1967 in Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi. That shit did not happen. He's a sophomore at Middle Tennessee State University and drops out to join the Army. I mean, when you see him in the video in 1970, he's got a nice suit on, he's got a nice tie on, his mustache is trimmed, he's got his hair cut, and when he talks about what happened to Milai and that he shot a woman, and he swallows, right, hard when the guy asks him a follow-up question. And you can see he's fighting his own anxiety. And even in the story, as he relays it, he gets told to shoot this woman. Now, he's a black soldier in still largely segregated country, especially where he lives, and he's being told by white officers to shoot this woman. And he said, no, I don't want to shoot a woman, and you shoot her. And the lieutenant says, you know, disobeying a lawful order, I could shoot you, right? Well, not for disobeying an order that's not lawful. You can't shoot me. I'll shoot you first. And so he does everything he's supposed to do except not do it. And I don't know if that's not too much to expect from somebody in that situation. I probably were I him and grew up in that culture, right? I probably would have done that too. I don't know if I would have the moral courage to say no.
The thing from there, you don't even have to listen to the audio. For me, what I pick up out of there, the thing that's most important to me is the body language. It's 20 years later, the second video, where he's sitting on his chair in his hometown, and he's talking about it again. He's reliving it. He's got this scrapbook on his lap. You can see the pain of what that... most people, you can't see pain. like this guy. This guy's exuding, I mean, real physical and mental pain dealing with this 20 years later. And I think it was 9 years after that other interview, he took his life. So, you know, and I'm watching this, and you could see him expressing in his hand, his legs, his face, everything, his micro expressions of just raw pain of making the wrong decision, not keeping your honor clean, making the wrong decision. And he knows this. And, you know, to me, he's still a strong guy, because I don't know if I would have lasted 29 years living with something like that. I mean, he existed for, you know, and that's the thing is, you know, he didn't live, he existed after that, after March 16th, 1968. After that, he ceased living as a human being. And in the first interview, he's actually trying to make sense of it. He's trying to rationalize. He's trying to convince himself that what he did, he believed was the right thing. And then all of that time just stewing on that. And I think to myself, what could have been done for an individual like that? Could he have lived a normal life? And it's very difficult to come to the conclusion of no. I mean, he violated one of the most sacred things of keeping your honor clean, where we talk about putting your head on the pillow every night. You know, can you live with yourself?
Let me offer you this. As good as you can do, if you were him, and I talked to Sergeant Major Green about that, and I would love to do this, is you can find somebody doing like post-traumatic winning, right? And I would just say this, Marines from Haditha, Marines from Hamadiyah,
yeah,
and say, I want to talk to people about what we did, and I want to make them smarter, tell them what was in our head, how it got there, the mistakes we make, so they don't have to. They won't do that. That's as good as it gets.
You can. I don't know if that would take away the pain.
No. You can't take away the pain, right? You can try to bury it, right?
Yeah.
And I saw an article written about Haditha, guys in Haditha, and the last paragraph when they talked to a Marine, the reporter says, "Were these good kills or bad kills?" And it reminded me of the Varnado Simpson thing. And his response was, they're just kills, implying that they're all the same.
Right. Killing is killing.
Right. He's trying to convince himself.
Right.
Right.
It ain't going to work, buddy.
Right. Because he's running from it, because we know the truth.
Right.
They ain't just kills. They're different. And we know that. And so, but to me, the only thing you can offer them is you can offer your experience. You can, to quote Mike, you can take responsibility for your actions. You can stand up in front of people and say, I made a mistake. And I want to offer you my testimony so that you won't make the mistake. And I think that, and Sergeant Major Green and I talked about this, and I would love to do that. But that's as good as it gets.
I think you and I, a while back ago had a discussion about killing in combat. And I think you had asked me the question of something in the words of, is there a fine line between murder and killing, you know, killing combatants? And we went at that for quite some time. And, you know, at first I was, the line is pretty wide. I mean, there's a difference between murder and killing. You can't convince me, that, you know, they're very, very close. That's it. We're talking like a thread. No, it's not a thread. We're talking like, you know, it's a football field thick, of information. But the other thing that gets me thinking, and I'm not going to name names, Mac knows I live with some of the anger I live with is people died over there that shouldn't have died. And we shouldn't have done things. We shouldn't have been places. We shouldn't have gone places. We went places we shouldn't have been. And people ultimately paid the ultimate price for that. And I get the, hey, it's combat. But it goes back to, and I've said this to Marines.
Hold on a second.
He didn't need to die that day.
Mike and I, through fate, have been involved in a number of incidences that we don't know each other are involved in from very different yeah. physical locations.
From perspectives.
And
you on the higher side, right. Looking down in the microscope, yeah. Me at ground level, looking at the effect
from the subordinate unit there, looking back up. And it's interesting because we deal with the exact same issues.
And we draw the same conclusions.
We draw the exact same conclusions. And we took actions relative to those conclusions at the time. And we've had some very interesting stories. And I appreciate Mike not mentioning names because, it's hard. I mean, and I know it's hard for Mike. It's when you think about people that die unnecessarily, that's hard. That's hard stuff. And especially, right, there's no heavier burden than if they die and somebody was negligent or disobeyed an order and they got killed. And that's what happened in this case.
We were involved one time in a raid ambush type thing, and we went in and we killed some bad guys. Unfortunately, we killed some civilians, and it was collateral damage, and it was acceptable. It wasn't acceptable to me. I was upset, and we got back, and I voiced my opinion, and I said, behind closed doors, and I pulled the parties aside, and I said, listen. We can call it as it is, and I know it went in the official rule book as collateral damage, and we killed the guys that deserved to be killed. However, in my eyes, they've been bad people, and they deserve to die, but not today. Not that way. Not in that situation. Because we are better. That's the separation for me, and that was always the part is, we were always the better people there. We were the more intellectual. We had purpose. We were there for a purpose. And when you do that, in my eyes, when we did that stuff, we lost our purpose. We lost our way. We became them. We were no better than the enemy we were fighting in some cases.
We're the good guys.
And we
believe that. And when you become the bad guys, is when you do the same thing that the bad guys.
When you're killing out of anger,
right.
That's different. Now,
and you're reckless. To me, I remember.
You become reckless.
People ask you a question about worlds of engagement. You know, they're so bullshit. They're so tight. And I would say, you know what?
No.
The people that tell you that, I deal with the rules of engagement every day. And I can tell you this. I can defend anybody I need to defend.
Right.
We can kill anybody we need to kill. But some of the stupid, reckless stuff, for instance, you know, at night going to yoke somebody up and dogs start barking, somebody in an adjacent compound looks over the wall to see what's going on. Poof, popped in the head, dead. What? Did you see a weapon? No, I just saw a head. And you killed him? Yes.
Hmm.
Okay. And so people wonder how that whole no night raids happened. You know? And so...
shooting guys for just having cell phones out.
Well, that's different.
But you have to look at the whole situation.
I know.
We were shooting guys for cell phones and walking on the side of the street.
Because they were weapons.
What was he near? He was near anything. He was out in the open.
But he was looking at us, and he got on the cell phone.
I would look at you if you drove by me.
I wouldn't. I'd run. Right?
Knowing the outcome is, if I'm on your cell phone, never look at the troops when they're going by.
Right.
Ever.
Because
you will die.
How did we get here? All right. We got to go to bed. Final thoughts on today, Mike.
Final thoughts on today. You know, again, I think for me, the learning, the takeaway for me, it's going to take a few days after this to sit there and to go through and relive this again and to hear this, again. And the learning though, for me, I think it's interesting to me, but they don't know, the guys out there, the Marines that are out in front of us, what they don't know about me is I'm learning about myself more today. I'm learning about them. It's like they look at us like, well, whoa, this is like, we got the answers. Here's the burning bush. You know, the waves just parted. No, guys, you don't understand. We're still learning. We're learning ourselves where we need to be. The only difference is, I started the journey. I'm on that path. I'm, I'm going through. You just started the catalyst to start determining where you need to move. But for me, I'm still in that learning phase, and it's gonna, like I said, take some time to ingest this and kind of look at this, and then take a deep breath, you know, and get better with myself and kind of figure out, you know, who I am. That's the neat thing about this, you know.
Ooh. That was pretty deep.
That was deep.
I don't even think that's playable. It's deep. So I'll say a couple things. I think one is, you know, we asked the question in the presentation, actually Gunnar does, and he says, you know, is trauma worth your study? And I think the point of this, I mean, the fact is, we said to, like, I think I went to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning last night, right? It's like, it's not only worth your study, it is, in my opinion, the most fascinating thing to reflect upon, to study, because as Mike just described, it has a profound impact, not just on your life, but on the lives of other people. It's like the greatest investment of anything you could study is that, because of the impact it has in the ROI for you, for the people around you, and people you probably barely know.
Wait, ROI?
Return on investment. I'm Jewish. Oh. I always think about return.
I was like, ROE, I know. ROI, yeah. Rules of engagement, I know. ROI.
So, and the second part is this, you know, so if you're listening, right, and it's like, hey, we've done 10 presentations over 4 days, that's 25 hours of talking, it's the same, you know, more or less we're continuing to evolve and adapt, and the core of it's the same. And I just know that each time I get up there, I feel like it's the first time. And more importantly, that it's not coming from my head. Like, where that comes from is the depth, and I'll stop and kind of observe myself doing this from time to time. And it's this incredible experience of sharing from the depths of your heart and your soul what you've learned and the passion that is brought with that to a remarkable community. And I want to stress in that, and I think we've talked a little bit about this, is, you know, we all, and I think we do right, complain and talk about this millennial generation, which is anyone who's 38 and under, in the way in which they look at the world, and not just the snowflake culture, but also the prioritization of fame and money and quick money, right? Not hard-earned money, but quick money and those sorts of things. And in the midst of that culture, that being the dominant narrative and dominant set of values, you have a group of people who chose door number 4 to go do something incredibly and profoundly hard and challenging and adverse. And they did that because they are warriors, and something in them calls them to something greater than themselves, in spite of all that surrounds them. And that, to me, is so gratifying. And I will never forget each time I get to stand up there and I look, and it's just Marines as far as my eyes can see. And I'm like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I get to stand up here, thanks to Mac and the invitation to be here, and do this. I'm like, this is the stuff right here. And it goes back to what we said last night, right? I'm doing exactly what I want to be doing, and I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be doing it. And that continues, and that's amazing. It's a blessing. It's a gift.
Yeah, I guess to me, my thoughts go back to tonight being with spouses and how interested they were to hear this. And the beauty of this presentation, it's not a military-centric message. It's a Marine-centric message, certainly, all right, because it's based in our culture and the truths that come out of our culture. But what I love was that, you know, women showed up and said, my husband was he couldn't stop talking about this last night. He called me driving home because he wanted to talk to me about it, and he couldn't wait till he got home. And you hear that stuff, and you're like, wow. And then after it, you're thinking, you ask them, what'd you think? And they're like, oh my God, I'm like, I'm totally blown away by this. And it's just a cool experience.
Can I say one? I was staring at these spouses, and I'm thinking, right. And I'm like, you know, let's talk. You should talk about it. And I'm like, how many times do you think that those spouses tried to get or said to their husbands, like, you got to talk about this. It's really important to talk about. And I'm like, and they must be looking at me. It's like you have three heads of like, and now it's like, you know, the CG is up there talking about his stuff. And
they just told me that you have to talk to me. Yeah. Don't make me rat you out. I don't want to talk to you. They told me that you have, it will make you stronger. And We were talking like we're screwing so many guys over because that's what we did.
When she said, you're vulnerable right now, and that's what we like to see. And I'm thinking to myself, those poor guys, when they get home, oh my God, they're going to, you know, some of those guys are my buddies, and they're going to be like, oh, okay.
Is there anything you want
to But you know what we talked about? The only thing that can come of that, and this is like where it gets like creepy. You know, we talk about be gentle with yourself, which is not, but the only thing that comes of that will be greater intimacy between you and your spouse because you've let her, and again, she don't have to bring her all the way into it, but she's a shock absorber. She deals with it when we go there. So she ought to demand, hey, you need to take me part of the way. So I can understand this better. I want to feel closer to you because I feel like I can't understand. So can you take me up to the gross part, you know, and kind of generalize for me, you know? And I think the only thing that can come out of that is greater intimacy. And I think that's a good thing and more confidence that we can go here in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's a good thing.
I agree. And I'm going to get out of it before you guys want to start hugging.
Okay, look, can I say one thing?
I'm not a hugger.
Let me say one thing. Sit
you
down.
You said one thing.
Yeah, I know. I'm the one more thing. That's my nickname.
My God.
The point is, so intimacy is defined, or at least a definition, is fearlessly knowing and being known. And you can, and Mike talked about
Hold
being
on.
Free.
Wait.
Fearlessly knowing and being known.
Knowing and being known.
Right? So you're not afraid. You're not afraid of someone seeing all of you, right? The parts of you that you don't talk about. Right. And when you take Vornado, right? What does he say, though? He says because of what he did, that he won't allow anyone to get close to him. He won't allow anyone to love him because he doesn't believe he's worthy of any of that. And it's such an interesting part of trauma and struggle is when you say there's nothing wrong with you, what people think before that message is there is something wrong with me and I'm not deserving of this stuff. And then you go and you engage in sabotage and all these things. And this is the antidote to that stuff is when people can accept who they are and how they are. You're absolutely right. Relationships of all kind can flourish. And we know that that's the key to a good life. And that's how all this stuff fits together. And it's just, it builds on each other, builds on itself. I'm done.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it. The All Warrior Radio Network.